Let's jump back into the book of Exodus. Chapter number 12 is where we are. And I want to repeat verse number 16 as we resume the context of where God is giving Moses instructions about the very first Passover, but also all the subsequent festival commemorations of Passover that are going to take place in the future. And so we got a lot of detailed information here and helpful, I think, in us understanding even the calendar system of the Jewish people. And also the prophetic nature of some of the things that happened with Jesus as he fulfilled in his day the point of the Passover, which is that Jesus would be the ultimate Passover lamb that would take away the sins of those that put faith in him. So we've got two holidays that are actually jammed together here. Passover is the 14th day of the first new Jewish month, which is going to take place in the spring. And that is the day on which the lambs are butchered. They have their throats cut, and then the lamb is prepared by being roasted over an open fire. The 15th day, which starts at sunset, is the beginning of the 7 days of unleavened bread that is mentioned here. And as I already told you, it's related in that first year to the week of travel that took place from the Exodus day until they had crossed the Red Sea and the Egyptian pursuit force had been dealt with perfectly by God. And so at that point, they didn't need to move rapidly any longer. They could take their time and go back to letting their bread rise with leaven. All right, so verse number 16. On the first day, that is, first day of unleavened bread, the 15th, you shall hold a holy assembly. Think of it as kind of a holiday kickoff gathering of all the people. And then on the seventh day, a holy assembly, which is kind of the wrap-up gathering together of the people. No work shall be done on those days, but what everyone needs to eat, that alone may be prepared by you. So everybody takes the day off on the 15th in the future. Everybody takes the 21st off in the future. And you get together with friends and family to worship and celebrate, all of that sort of thing. And you can make meals on those 2 days. Now, these days, some people are in the habit of referring to them as Sabbath days. But be cautious in that, because the Sabbath day is a distinct day every single week. It is the seventh day of the week. And on that day, food preparation doesn't even take place. The food preparation happens the day before, and then you eat them without preparing them. So that is a more distinct characteristic of a Sabbath that you do not see with these two holidays at the beginning of unleavened bread and at the end of unleavened bread. Verse 17. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this very day I brought your hosts out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, you shall observe this day throughout your generation as a statute forever. So the 15th is going to be the day of departure, and that's why it becomes the first day of the feast of unleavened bread. The 14th is when they butcher the animal that will be eaten at the meal that will take place either on the 14th or into the 15th. And that's the New Testament issue that I shared yesterday, that by the time the first century rolls around, because the text says that the lamb, the Passover lamb, is to be butchered between the evenings, that some Jewish people butchered it after the sun went down and began the 14th, and so they would eat it on that same evening that the 14th began, while others would butcher the lamb at the tail end of the afternoon of the 14th, and then cook and eat the meal as the 15th began. Now, that's actually how the Israeli people did it as a whole in the first Exodus. But in the first century, both time periods can be shown. And the really key thing, I think, was it allowed Jesus to eat the official Passover meal with his apostles on the Thursday night after the sun went down and still be the Passover lamb the next day being crucified on the afternoon of the 14th. And so I want to emphasize that because I think that becomes a sticking point for some people who do not understand how the calendar system was being observed by the Jews in the time of Jesus. All right, verse number 18. In the first month, from the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. Meaning, when the sun goes down on the 14th and starts the 15th, that's when you should be having unleavened bread. And you should keep eating unleavened bread until the sun goes down on the 21st and starts the 22nd. And then you can go back to having leavened bread. Verse 19, for 7 days, no leaven is to be found in your homes or your houses. If anyone eats what is leavened, that person will be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a sojourner or a native of the land. And I went into detail explaining that the phrase shall be cut off has three levels of seriousness. The first one is you can be basically excommunicated from the community of believers, kind of shunned because you were not following the proper observance of Passover and unleavened bread. Second level is if you continued that sort of rudeness, then you would be kicked out of Israel, basically told you have to leave. So you'd be exiled. Because you refuse to live up to the standards given by God. The third most serious one was if you came back from that exile and still refused to live by the standards, then really there was no other choice but to execute you, because you refused to live by the standards, but you also kept insisting that you could stay where those standards were law. And so that's the meanings of the to be cut off from the land. And it didn't matter whether you were ethnic Israeli or just somebody living there in the country. You were expected to observe these customs during this 7-day period. And you'll still see the same thing when you go to Israel now, that you're really being rude and unthoughtful if you violate some of the Sabbath standards or some of the Passover standards there in the presence of Israelis who are doing them. And so basically, when you're where you're living or where you're at, you do according to the customs of that place. I think we actually have a saying like that. When in Rome, do as the Romans. In this case, when in Israel, do as the Israelis. Verse 20, you shall eat nothing leavened. In all your dwelling places, you shall eat unleavened bread. And then God is finished with the instructions. So Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, go and select the lambs for yourselves according to your clans and kill the Passover lambs. Now, as I shared with you yesterday, I think some of these instructions were given earlier in the time, in the timeline of the events we're looking at here. In other words, when Moses first came to Israel, or to the Israelis, he may have already had some of these instructions. And one of those instructions was that you set aside the Passover lambs on the 10th day of the month. So I think they probably did that in this year. And we know chronologically that that would have happened the day before the 3 days of darkness happened. They happened on the 11th, 12th, and 13th. So that when the 14th came, after the sun was back shining again, that was the day on which this next event was supposed to happen, is you take the lambs you've already selected back on the 10th, and verse 21 finishes, kill the Passover lambs. So you butcher them so that you can now do the Passover procedures. And now we have them repeated again with detail. Take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood that is in the basin. Touch the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning. So here we have the hyssop, which is an herb, a very sweet-smelling herb that is used like a splatter brush. You dip it in the lamb's blood that you've just caught when you butchered it. And you put it on the top and the two sides. And as I said, I think this is some prophetic symbolism that reminds us of the sign of the cross, that Jesus had blood on his head, on both of his outstretched arms, hands, and also at his feet. And of course, if you splatter stuff on the top of a doorpost, it's also going to drip down at the foot of that door. And so the Israelis were then supposed to stay inside that blood-marked house in order to be passed over by the destroyer. And Jesus, of course, becomes the one who is the ultimate Passover lamb that keeps us being passed over by the judgment that is due our sins, because he took those sins away from us as far as the east is from the west. Verse 23, for he who is will pass through to strike the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, he who is will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your houses to strike you. So God is the one who is orchestrating this, but there also does seem to be a destroyer angel working on his behalf in those places where the blood is not seen. Then a reminder, this becomes a ritual for future observance. Verse 24, you shall observe this rite as a statute for you and for your sons forever. So every single year, the Israelis were supposed to go through this reminder meal of the Passover to tell them, this is how God redeemed us out of Egypt. Verse 25, when you come to the land that he who is will give you, as he's promised, you shall keep this service. And when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? You shall say, it is the sacrifice of he who is his Passover, for he passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians, but spared our houses. So this is part of the reason why modern day Jews have very systematized the Passover to include some young person asking pointed questions during the meal so that the story can be retold. Now, I will warn you, I do not believe that the Seders, the S-E-D-E-R-S, the Seders that are out there about Passover procedures represent what was done in the first century. I think they represent something that was adopted well after the destruction of the Second Temple and the barring of Jewish people from ever coming within distance of Jerusalem ever again. And so I'm talking about in probably the late 100s and early 200s is when I think these Passover Seders were designed first. So when I do my Last Supper meal each year, I do not follow those patterns because I do not think they are historically representative of what happened in the first century or even before that. All right, just kind of a throw out there for you, for those that might wonder about the Seders. So once Moses gives this information to the Israelites, it says the people bowed their heads and worshiped. So they accepted this as the word of God. And then the people of Israel went and did so as he who is had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. At midnight, so that is in the middle of the night, on the 15th. So the Passover lambs had been set aside on the 10th. The plague of darkness happened on the 11th, 12th, and 13th. The Passover lambs were then butchered at some point in the day of the 14th, up to the late afternoon of the 14th. It was then cooked, and then the Israelis got together in their little blood-marked houses, and they began eating the Passover meal. And they would have been finished by the time midnight arrived. And it says here, at midnight, he who is struck down all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne, which I've shared with you before. I think it's very clear historically and chronologically that we're talking about Thutmose III being the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And we know that he was followed by a non-firstborn son. There's mention of this firstborn son in documents up to a certain point, and then he's gone from the scene. And I think the reason he's gone from the scene is because his father, Thutmose III, did not accept the commands of God and therefore did not mark his house with the blood of the Lamb, and therefore his heir died. And that's why the next man that's on the throne points to the fact that I'm not the firstborn of my father, but the gods gave me this position. Now, he's got the wrong god in mind, because I think he's actually thanking the Sphinx or some sort of related god to the Sphinx with a plaque saying, I'm not the firstborn, but I am the Pharaoh. Okay, so from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon and all the firstborn of the livestock. Now, understand, it's all those who have not marked their houses and stayed inside. Strangely enough, there seems to have been some non-Israelis who went through the procedures and blood marked their house and stayed inside and were therefore spared. And these will be part of this mixed multitude we'll read about later that will leave Egypt with the Israelis, because they're kind of already moving toward this idea that this God of the Israelis, this Yahweh, this He who is more powerful than the gods of Egypt. But all of those who were unmarked died. And the majority of them would have been older. Some of them, of course, would have been young children. Verse 30. Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. So it was widespread death. And he had been warned about this from the very beginning. The exact words of God through Moses, through Aaron, to the Pharaoh was, if you do not let my firstborn son Israel go, I will kill your firstborn son. And now he has done that because the Pharaoh would not let him go. And now there's great grief up and down the chain of prominence within Egypt. Verse 31, then he summoned Moses and Aaron by night. Now he does not bring them into his presence. We already know from another passage that that was never going to happen again. So this is a verbal summoning, and said, up, go out from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go serve he who is as you said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also. So he now complies with everything that had been commanded and demanded of him. All Israelis can leave with all of their families, with all of their belongings, with all of their animals. You may now go. Now, they will go permanently, not just temporarily. When this was first broached, it was that they wanted to be able to go 3 days' journey into the wilderness where they could sacrifice to God. But they made no promises they would come back. So this is permanent, and Pharaoh seems to be on board with them leaving. Verse 33, the Egyptians, and we're talking about the pure-blood Egyptians, were urgent with the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we will all be dead. And this is another thing that God predicted, was that when the time came, the Egyptians would be quite insistent that the Israelis leave. You've got to leave. We don't want you here anymore. And in this case, they are communicating that up and down, both to the Pharaoh, who is their boss, and down to the Israelis, that if we don't get these Israelis out of here, their God is going to kill us all. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls being bound up in their cloaks on their shoulders. So they take the unleavened bread that they had prepared. And the people of Israel had also done as Moses told them, for they had asked the Egyptians for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. And he who is had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have what they asked. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. This was also something that was done ahead of time. God had told the Israelis, when the Egyptians tell you to leave, you need to tell them to pay you for your back services, that they need to give you things of value to make up for the fact that you've been held in slavery for all this time. So they follow through with that. And this is the reason why the Israelis have so much silver, gold, and precious fabrics and precious jewels whenever they're at Mount Sinai and the call goes out for donations to build the tabernacle. It's because of this call for back pay. And a lot of back pay was needed. Verse 37. And the people of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Sukkot, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. And so this is the first time we come across the number we'll see in the book of Numbers later, that the population of ethnic Israelis living all over Egypt, because some of them were probably being used as slaves up and down the Nile, those people were called back to the Delta region as the plagues are happening, so that all the Israelis are in the same place, the land of Goshen, whenever the time for the Exodus occurs. So there's about 600,000 adult men. So these would be the men of 20 years of age and older, or maybe 21 years and older, depending on how you do the breakpoint when this topic of 20 comes up later. So You've got all of those men, plus all of their wives and all of their children. So a nice conservative estimate is several million Israelis are going to be leaving here. Now the question might be, how could they get to that number in 430 years? And the answer is fairly simply. If you run the numbers and understand that they've got a fairly long life, and the numbers include having pretty big families, then just plugging in the number of each family having 9 kids, you can get from 70 people to several millions of people in a 430-year period. It can be done. While the numbers seem really large, I think they are very much to be accepted as inspired and accurate. They also have a mixed multitude with them and very much livestock, both flocks and herds. That's mentioned there in verse 38. But you'll see here that they're leaving from Ramesses. That's also mentioned in Numbers 33, starting at verse 3, because that's the full list of all the encampments that the Israelis make on their way from Egypt to the Promised Land. Ramesses is probably located somewhere to the northeast of Heliopolis, along the south, the most eastern of the branches of the Nile that run through the delta. That is probably where the land of Goshen was located. It's not named after the pharaoh Ramesses, but rather after the god Ra. The R-A there stands for the sun god. The Menses part means the outflowing of. So this city of Ramesses was devoted to the god of Ra. And that's our starting point, and we'll talk about that a little bit more tomorrow.